This week on Your Western Context, a John A. McDonald statue is removed in Victoria. A Stats Canada report on Alberta jobs gives conflicting info. Diplomatic troubles with Saudi Arabia raises questions of energy independence. And Maxime Bernier raises a discussion about multiculturalism. This is Western Context, episode 81, recorded Tuesday, August 14th, 2018. What is a Canadian? Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us once again for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are in once again this week after a little bit of a break. Welcome back.
Good to be back again. Of course, we're in the middle of August, so right in smack dab in the middle of Canadian summer. So wherever you are, hopefully the weather is nice. And we've got lots of stories to talk about this week after our break last week. Lots to talk about that was not really talked about that much in the news, and certainly a lot of different angles that weren't covered.
That's right, and you know, we've been doing this for the better part of a year and a half now, removing bias and sensationalism from the news and media, and providing you with all that information and context necessary to put you on the right side of the news, and we're going to do just that after that little bit of a break we took for some summer vacationing. So, what do you got for us for our first story?
All right, so our first story, me being out of province, was very surprised that my very own hometown of Victoria managed to make themselves put in the news, and usually when your own hometown is put into the news, it's usually not for a good reason, and in this case, it was definitely not a good reason. This was right outside of City Hall, where they removed the statue of our first Prime Minister, John A. Macdonald, right from the front steps of City Hall. Now, what they did, the reason why they did this is because they say it was because of his role as a leader of violence against Indigenous peoples and creating the residential school system. So what happened there was Victoria Mayor Lisa Help said that it was a year of discussion and deliberation, and that they decided that it was going to be many years of reconciliation. One of the things we heard very clearly from Indigenous family members is that coming to City Hall to do this work and walking past John A. Macdonald every time feels contradictory. And if the city is serious about reconciliation, which I would say that we are, then one important thing we do is temporarily remove the statue from the steps of City Hall. So from the city, directly from the mayor herself, she says that this is something that is going to go a long ways towards reconciliation with First Nations peoples. Now, there are a lot of questions about whether the statue will be able to come back, and all we know right now is that it will be temporary, and that Lisa Helps has said there's going to be no timeline for when that might happen. She said there is no timelines, no agendas, no deliverables. The process of reconciliation is a process of relationship building, truth telling, trust building. The discussions and the dinners will continue, and we'll see what comes of that. So this is something that happened very, very quickly. You might remember a couple months ago there were some talk of different statues in the United States that were removed, and I believe this was after the Charlottesville protests.
About 1 year ago, actually, to the day.
Yes, pretty close to the day. So this was almost like it was planned to happen directly after as a result of that. And there were some statues that were removed in Ontario, a few across the country. And at the time, a Victoria statue of John A. Macdonald was rumored at the time, but they said they weren't going to move forward on that. Well, it appears that they clearly have done that now. Now, it's amazing how it did happen pretty suddenly, and it was actually pretty sudden that it didn't actually have the unanimous support of City Council. Councillor Jeff Young said that while he believes it's important to respect the feelings of those who say that they were hurt by the presence of the monument, the issue deserved more discussion. He said, "The fact is, all of our historical leaders will have expressed opinions today that we've found distasteful. Among those leaders, I include the city councils of today, of who endorse policies that the future might find distasteful." And I think that raises an interesting point, into that not everyone is perfect, and everyone holds opinions and beliefs that not everyone else will agree with. And I think this is something very clear, especially when we go back 150 years to when our country was first founded. And, of course, Johnny Macdonald being the first prime minister, it's pretty obvious that there are going to be beliefs and belief systems from back then that aren't going to hold true today and that aren't going to hold up in the modern era, basically because they had different priorities of how the world should work. You have to put yourself back in time to that time period. Canada, the British North American colonies were under threat of American invasion at the time. There was problems of financing, problems of transportation, getting goods from one province to another, even just surviving on the land, taming much of the wilderness that Canada actually was. So a lot of what was happening at the time was trying to build Canada as a country, and there wasn't really much time to focus on a lot of other issues, such as, you know, people's feelings, for instance, or thinking about how other people think on the subject. The government of the day was thinking, okay, we need to make this work, we need to make it happen now, because if we don't, something bad will happen to Canada, we might not even have a country. And it's through our forefathers that we actually have a country to live in these days, to be able to actually sit here and record a podcast. So I think that's something else that should be mentioned, and that really wasn't mentioned very much in the news at all as well.
And, you know, when you look at, going back to John A. Macdonald, it does come down to that railroad that was built across the country, and that, in effect, tied the country together. And, you know, other countries have various similar things. The American 13 colonies, for example, were all built on, you know, the colonization from the British, but then their identities flourished and diverged based on that. And eventually they came to become known as the United States of America because of their common, I guess you could call it a common thread against Great Britain at the time, taxation without representation. So the point is that each country has its own defining characteristic. And even if you look at everything John A. Macdonald did, there's still things, such as the railroad, that built Canada. And without that, there likely wouldn't be a Canada in place. And, you know, if you want to look at John A. Macdonald for what he did regarding the residential schools, you do also have to look at all the other prime ministers that came after him, going up, in fact, all the way to Pierre Trudeau in the 70s, who did support the residential school system. It did end around that time. But every prime minister, from John A. Macdonald all the way to Trudeau, did end up having a hand in the residential school system and supporting it, even if they didn't do anything to remove it. And, you know, I pointed this out with the bike lane story when we had that with Mayor Helps. Perhaps she thought she was just helping the situation. Perhaps she just thought she was helping the situation again. But that, maybe that's just because that's in her name.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that was one of the reasons why she was elected, was her name Helps, and she was saying that she was going to help Victoria.
Right.
And one of the things I think we should also look at with in this one is that when it comes to John A. Macdonald and the statue being removed, not even 100% of Victoria residents were even on board with this. I think there were many different polls that were taken after the fact by many different news organizations, and a lot of it, you know, you could, as with all polls, you have to take a grain of salt, of course. But with these, a lot of them were saying that it was like roughly 70 to 80 to 90% of people that were polled said that they didn't agree with the statue being taken down. And for a bunch of different reasons, a lot of it was not because of Johnny Macdonald and who he was, but that because if you want to truly have reconciliation, you can't just remove pieces of history that you don't like. You have to learn from it and make sure that you don't make the same mistakes again. And by taking down a statue, you can have a statue there, the person, someone comes up and you've got your kids with you, and they ask you, who is that? You say, that's John A. Macdonald, that was the first prime minister. He was not a perfect person, but he was one of the reasons why Canada exists, and I think that's a fair statement to say. So when the statue was taken down on last Friday morning, there was a lot of protests that were going on. A lot of bystanders started singing "O Canada." Hard to know whether that was the new general neutral "O Canada" or not. A lot of people applauded. There was a lot of people that booed, and there were a bunch of people that said the na-na-na, hey-hey, goodbye, that can be found in a lot of different sporting events as well, to try and drown out those people that were singing O Canada. There were a bunch of people that were wrapped in Canadian flags. They said that describing the removal was kind of like a funeral process, and a lot of people said that they didn't support taking down the statue because they wanted more debate on whether it should happen. They wanted it to see to come to an actual vote or something, like a lot of municipal issues do. A lot of people want more say in what goes on in their own neighborhood. So they say that countering opinions that the presence of the statue promotes educational dialogue about history, a lot of people said that if that's the case, then it has failed. And taking down the statue has definitely created a lot of discussion on the matter, but it's not the type of discussion that people are talking about, because it's not bringing people together. It's actually dividing people further. It's putting them into camps on whether they want the statue to come down or whether they wanted to keep it. So now everyone is divided on the issue, whereas before we could have just had a discussion on the issue and what was going on, much like we're doing right now.
Yeah, and you know, I think one final thing on this is that anyone who's taken a history class will know that, you know, history is good. It's good to know and it's good to remember. But at the same time, if you can't interpret the history and ask yourself what if happened in this specific historical moment, and what if this changed, where would we be today? And history isn't just a static object. It's something that lives to be interpreted. And by removing pieces of history, we're in effect removing pieces of the Canadian identity.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of Canadian history to go over. And a lot of Canadians might not even know that much about their history. And there was a lot of good things that happened in Canada to make it the country that we know today. We are a bastion of freedom and democracy, of course, and there are lots of good things that happened to create the Canadian identity that we know today, including, you know, all the stereotypes about maple syrup and hockey and all that sort of thing. But, of course, like all history, there was a lot of bad things that happened in history, residential school systems being probably one of the worst. So that's something that people have to talk about, they have to learn about it, and then learn from those mistakes to make sure that they don't repeat them. And by taking down a statue that would promote that sort of conversation, it's actually hindering people from talking about it rather than what it is. And people, you might wonder, well, how is a simple statue going to stop that from happening? It's not the statue itself, it's the symbolism of it. And it's taking it down, and taking down that symbolism means that it's actually more difficult to have that conversation.
And that is entirely what's lost in that debate. And I really wish someone had asked this question or had this discussion out there, but that's why we're doing that right now. All right, so our next piece of news here comes from Alberta. And, you know, the Alberta unemployment numbers came out for the month of July. And, you know, there are some questions about this one, because the headline read as follows: national unemployment rate falls to four-decade low. And 4 decades is, of course, 40 years. And that's a very long time when you're looking at modern economic history. And the subheadline was, Alberta's numbers are less rosy. So Canada's nationwide unemployment rate dropped to this 40-year low as of this past July. That puts the national unemployment rate in at 5.8%. So you might be wondering what's happening in Alberta with this. Well, in Alberta, the unemployment rate rose from 6.5% to 6.7% as employment held steady, while full-time work decreased. We'll have more on that in just a moment here in this reporting here. And since we are, you know, based primarily in the West, we'll also mention BC's unemployment rate. BC's unemployment rate dropped to a very low 5%. Well, Saskatchewan is still a shade lower than Alberta at 6.6%. And if you look into Alberta specifically here, Edmonton's unemployment rate sits at 6.5%, while Calgary's unemployment rate increased to 7.9%. from 7.7%. And this leads the country in some of the highest unemployment rates out of, you have to go pretty far east to find this, all the way out to the Maritimes. So this is an issue for Calgary. Now, we'll get back to the Alberta numbers in just a minute, because, you know, these reports are always interesting to look at, because they can be taken one way or the other. They can be taken that, oh, this is good because the rate's going down a bit. But there's also other different shades in there. So, for example, here, nationally, the country gained 82,000 part-time jobs last month. But while that was happening, it lost 28,000 full-time jobs. So you can see there's a bit of a difference there. And we've had this discussion before many times on the podcast about part-time versus full-time and which of those you ultimately want to be creating in the economy. So this 28,000 is indeed a troubling remark, but it gets a little bit more murky as we go forward with this. Now, industry-wise, the services sector saw the biggest gain with a net increase for both full and part-time jobs of 90,500 jobs. So services sector is, of course, referring to retail stores and whatnot, and that's where, of course, we see part-time jobs as well. Now, the situation does get more odd in Alberta with this because if you look at Alberta on its own, private employment is down in Alberta, but public employment, that is employment run by the government, and self-employment are both up. And, you know, this is a really odd question to see in an economic report because it means that there's less hiring going on and more people perhaps starting their own businesses or entering the contracting profession. Now, according to economics professor Trevor Tom, he says he's not sure what to make of it, but it doesn't seem ideal. And, you know, that's right, because as an economy, we are in a situation where we're not a Soviet socialist economy where the government is to provide all forms of production and all forms of employment. We're not there. We are, you know, an economy that is based around market principles and market policies, and that focuses in on the private sector, of course. So you don't want to see private employment going down, but public sector employment and self-employment going up, because that's just something that, you know, I have a bit of experience with economics, and I was trying to figure out what this meant when I was reading this story. And, you know, as Trevor Tom also says, he's not sure what to make of this as well. And questions were ultimately raised about the data as well with this by both the NDP government and CIBC chief economist Avery Shenfield, who said that there are lots of reasons to question just how good this data is here that we're looking at with this. And, you know, I think at this point we should probably be looking into the data methodology on this from Statistics Canada, because are they asking, you know, if someone is self-employed, does that include contract work and what industries might that be in? And that data wasn't available in this jobs report. So that's going to be some questions going forward for Statistics Canada. Now, of course, with any jobs report, there comes the issues of political spin and whatnot. The United Conservatives use this to point out that while jobs are being created, they're government subsidized, and the recovery isn't really a recovery at all, and upwards of 21,000 jobs were lost. But in reality, the 21,000 jobs lost figure comes as an estimate from a confidence interval range on the Statistics Canada report. So basically, that means that, yeah, there could be perhaps 20,000 jobs lost, but there could be just 5,000 jobs lost based on the confidence interval that Statistics Canada provides. Because anytime you have a collection of data, statistics related, there is going to be what's called an error range, that is a difference plus or minus of how confident you are that the results are accurate. And when you apply that to jobs numbers, that does indeed give a bit of focus that, you know, the numbers could be higher or they could be lower, perhaps. So following this, the Alberta NDP echoed the concerns of the CIBC chief economist, saying that, you know, we're not sure how good this data is, and maybe this report is a bit of a blue moon, and we really should be focused on other aspects of this report rather than the fact that, you know, private employment is down, but self-employment and government employment is up. And, you know, overall, the number of jobs has been increasing since late 2016. We know it's, you know, just not in the private sector. The data here illustrates that. So economically speaking, depending on the data in any of one of these reports, could mean that any of the hypotheses could be true. The hypotheses of Trevor Tom could be true. The hypotheses of the NDP could be true. Or the hypotheses of the United Conservatives could also be true. So there's just no way of knowing at this point which one is ultimately true and which way it's going to happen and what's going to happen at the end of the day with this, without Statistics Canada increasing the clarity of questions it asks to self-employed individuals. So this is, you know, we don't know exactly what this is going to mean for the economy year over year or quarter over quarter. This is just 1 month. But it's a good time to just have a look and see what the media is reporting, see what all the NDP and United Conservative types are saying, and just take all the infographics and whatnot and the reports that come out with a grain of salt, because this is indeed an anomaly in the reporting here, and Statistics Canada doesn't ask the questions or doesn't have the methodology to drill down further just into what self-employment means and why it's up so much this past month.
Yeah, I think when you're taking jobs into account, it's hard to really quantify it just using simple numbers when it comes to job creation and job growth, because as we all know, everyone has a different job, and jobs differ in their quality, they differ in their pay, and they differ in their longevity as well. So it's hard to tell what exactly what will be created in the job market based on those principles. Now, something else that we also touched on earlier is the difference between part-time jobs created and full-time jobs created. And I think that's something that's really a bigger indicator of what the quality of the jobs are being created in the economy, because as we all know, full-time jobs usually give workers more benefits, not just in the benefits of full-time benefits that they get through either dental or healthcare or anything like that that get covered by their employer, but also benefits of having the stable job, having the guaranteed hours, and being able to work full-time, which usually means that your paycheck increases as well. So if full-time jobs are down and the private sector jobs are down, generally that's not a good thing in either case, because that means that if jobs in total numbers may be up, but the quality of jobs that are gained are not the ones that you want. So if you're, and also something that we talked about earlier a couple months ago when we were last talking about jobs, I believe, was the difference in quality between the full-time jobs and the part-time jobs as well. So if you're losing full-time jobs and gaining a lot of part-time jobs, it could mean that a lot of full-time positions are being eliminated and then being replaced with more part-time jobs, because of course one part-time job usually will take the place of two part-time jobs. So you'll have two people that are employed, but they're only going to be working about half as much to make up the amount. So in the economy, you need both, of course, to be able to fulfill what work needs to be done, but it also means that if you're not creating more full-time jobs, ultimately your economy is not really growing.
Yeah, and I mean, anytime you have questions that come in from one of these reports, I think we'll probably get more info at the end of the quarter once we have a better report of, you know, unemployment as a whole and more jobs numbers at the end of the quarter. But I think the very fact that people are questioning this is a good thing, but at the same time, it's a little bit hypocritical, because anytime a government questions something, but then the media jumps on them for questioning it, they get a lot of flack for that. But here we have a chief economist doing it, the government doing it, and the media is reporting that they are doing it. But at the same time, if it's any kind of other data that comes out there that's questioned, that's always an issue. So it was a little bit odd as to why this wasn't much more of an issue with this story. So.
Yeah, exactly. And it seems like there's a lot of questions to be asked about the different methodology as well. So that's something that can really only come through further analysis and further testing to be able to make sure that we actually get the statistics that we deserve. And of course, since we all pay into our taxes, hopefully, that means that Statistics Canada is basically a government body that works for us. So really, it's in the public's own interest to be able to have better information gathering and to make sure that the information gathered is actually accurate.
All right. So what do we got for our next story?
So for our next story is a story that even if you were living under a rock or if you weren't even turning on the news very often, you probably would have heard about, and that is, of course, the spat between Canada and everybody's favorite Middle Eastern oil superpower, Saudi Arabia. Now, this came about because of our Minister of Foreign Affairs, Chrystia Freeland, going onto Twitter and asking, well, not asking, but demanding the immediate release of civil rights activists in the country. And we're talking about concern over crackdown of dissidents by the Riyadh government. Now, this included Samar Badawi, who was the sister of imprisoned Saudi writer Raif Badawi, and they were in jail for insulting Islam. Now, Chrystia Freeland directly wrote, "Very alarmed to learn that Samar Badawi has been imprisoned in Saudi Arabia. Canada stands together with the Badawi family in this difficult time, and we continue to strongly call for the release of both Raif and Samar Badawi. Now, this was retweeted about a couple thousand times, and it's quite clear that it gained the attention of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Now, their response to this was pretty serious as well. They decided to withdraw all Saudi students that it has been sponsoring at Canadian universities and other schools in the country as well. Basically, directly all tied back to this tweet on the human rights record. So I think it's clear to say in 2018 that statements made by politicians on Twitter matter more than ever before. And it seems like whenever you go onto social media, you really have to take a grain of salt as to what you're reading, but also what is being said by our government on there, or any government, really, whether it be Canadian or American. I think it's fair to say that we really need to take those what's being said seriously, because clearly everyone else does as well. Now, Saudi Arabia also mentioned that their airlines were also going to suspend all flights to and from Toronto, and they're also going to put another bunch of measures in as well. So what this is going to affect, of course, is not just the amount of short-term international students, because, of course, there are quite a few numbers that come in from Saudi Arabia. They are sixth on the list of countries for how many come in. So that when they're coming into our universities and paying their full tuition, that's going to be a lot of income that's going to be lost by these universities. That's going to have to be gained through other means. So whether they're going to increase their tuitions for other students, whether domestic or foreign, this is going to have quite a different impact on people going back to school. And of course, we're almost into September now, so that's going to happen very, very quickly. And we're going to find out, students going back to university, how much they're going to have to pay and how much increase they're going to have to pay as well. It seems like with everything from taxes to auto insurance to all other facts of life that you have to pay into, you have to end up paying more. And things like this are just one of the things that are going to impact that as well. Now, something that was interesting about this was that Canada decided not to back down on this as well. They said that they were going to stand by what they said. They were going to continue to unapologetically criticize countries that they have deemed to not comply with human rights, and that they said that, quote, "There is nothing new or novel about Canada's support for human rights, very much including women's rights around the world and including Saudi Arabia." That was Chrystia Freeland again. Now, she did say that she couldn't mention how the dispute will affect that $15 billion deal to supply Saudi Arabia with the combat vehicles equipped with machine guns and cannons, you know, clearly to spread more freedom and democracy in the Middle East as well. Now, that was a deal that was put in place by the former conservative government, and then it was held up and approved eventually by the Trudeau government as well. So both the conservative and the liberal governments have had their hand in this deal, and it had been approved by both of them, despite all of this going on in Saudi Arabia. And I think it's been very clear over the past couple decades that Saudi Arabia, while they have a lot of oil reserves and it's very beneficial to have a positive working relationship with them, they're clearly not friends to the Western world. And there's a lot of countries that depend on them to supply oil. Now, there are a few countries that, of course, do have a lot of oil reserves, Canada being one of them, and that just begs the question as to why Canada is not, you know, developing their own oil reserves and being able to develop not just those oil reserves, but the means of transportation to get them around the country. And that is something that we have talked about at length on this show, I think, very, very, very many times before, quite a bit, when regarding either the Trans Mountain Pipeline to BC, the canceled Northern Gateway project by Trudeau that would have gone through the Yellowhead Highway up to Prince Rupert, and, of course, Energy East, which would have gone to Quebec. Now, something that should be mentioned on when it comes to oil dependence in Canada is that BC gets a lot of their oil from Alberta. And I think that is something that is clearly undeniable, and a lot of people in the Lower Mainland and on Vancouver Island would like to forget, but it is very true that most of our oil does come down through the Trans Mountain Pipeline from the refinery near Edmonton. Now, in the east, that's not really the case, because there is no pipeline to go through that, through the Canadian Shield, through Ontario into Quebec. So they have to get their oil from somewhere, and a lot of their refineries actually bring in their oil from a lot of the OPEC countries, either in the Middle East or in South America. Now, a lot of these countries do not have good records with human rights, and they do not have good records when it comes to democracy and freedom of expression and a lot of other women's rights that this Trudeau government is very concerned about. So this begs the question as to, on one hand, they can criticize these governments and on the other hand import these oil imports and then not want to have Canadian imports as well to coming from Alberta and from the West. So this is something that is going to have a huge impact on how Canada's economy will work, especially when it comes to oil and gasoline as well.
You know, I think when you look at this, this is one situation that people who are wanting to promote pipelines and promote energy growth and energy independence for North America and Canada to its own degree should be jumping up and down about. Because anytime there's a spat with Saudi Arabia, the price of oil goes up, and that, of course, means that consumers at the end of the day are going to be paying more. But at the other hand, if you had your own oil reserves and it had it flowing out east, if Trudeau was laying those pipelines down and if the governments along the way were receptive to that, we would be seeing a different measure on the oil prices out east. And, you know, this is maybe a blessing in disguise for the pro-oil folks, because this could be a great chance to promote Canadian energy and the Canadian economy as a whole. But I don't think we've seen that happening with this. It's been more about the human rights file, which I think that we should not deny that Saudi Arabia's human rights record is one of the worst in the world. And it's one of those situations where people turn a blind eye and just continue to buy the oil because they're the biggest producer. They produce at volume. And that, of course, means the cost is the lowest compared to where others can get it. So there are many net positives that could come out of this. And, you know, it's just a little bit interesting seeing such a ruckus raised about a diplomatic incident with Saudi Arabia when, at the end of the day, with some clever marketing and maybe some clever actions by the government, Canada could come out way ahead at the end of the day on this file.
Yeah, that's true. And we've seen from the Alberta government that they're heavily trying to promote pipelines. I think even in out of province, a lot of channels that you turn to will eventually turn to a commercial from the Alberta government promoting the Trans Mountain Pipeline at some point. And you'll see it in ads online as well, whenever you go to an ad space, at least for me. Maybe it's targeting me because I talk about the Trans Mountain Pipeline a lot, but it seems that there are a lot of ads being targeted towards Canadian energy as well. Now, something that came out about the same time as this as well is that it was found that the oil price discount has actually risen to its widest gap since 2013, and that is known as the Western Canada Select. It's now trading at below $40 US a barrel, and was actually a huge gap between the West Texas Intermediate, which is the American one, and they're trading at just under $70 a barrel. So not only are our oil reserves not being able to get to market, but we're also having to sell it for a lot cheaper than we should be able to as well. And that's something that being able to produce our own oil production, and not only that, but also live off of our own oil production rather than having to import it, would affect the price as well, of course. Now, a lot of that comes down to the pipelines, but it also comes down to a lot of oil producers having to sell their crude oil to foreign refineries for less money as well, and then having to buy it back again. A lot of refineries in Canada don't actually have the capacity to have the output for oil that is needed to be able to sustain in Canada. So just like with jade, where a lot of it is mined in BC and then shipped to China to be able to cut and carve, and then it's ended up selling back to us, we're basically doing the same with oil in the case where a lot of it ends up going down to the United States, down to the U.S. Gulf Coast refineries, and then gets sold back to us again. And that's something that really should be happening because it's our own product, and we really shouldn't be selling our own product for such a deep discount and then being able to buy it back again. That's not really what you should be doing to help the economy. And since Trudeau likes to put us into deficit and spend more and more money on social programs, you have to think that money has to come from somewhere. You would think that this would be a very good way to be able to do that, but it seems like the conversation in the media has not been on our own energy independence, and it's instead been talking about this human rights, and the focus has been on Saudi Arabia, when, as it always should be, we should be looking inwards to see how we can help ourselves, because as we can see with the situation with Saudi Arabia, there's not really been many countries out there that have actually been supporting Canada in this. Mostly because a lot of them have to deal with Saudi Arabia as well, and they don't want to make them mad, but also because they feel like it's better to work on their own countries rather than criticizing others for how they deal with business. And that is one of the reasons why Saudi Arabia took such a huge step on this, because they were offended that Canada was criticizing them, but then still buying from them and still doing trade deals with them. So it's almost like the American way of doing things is trying to force trade deals and then criticizing them after the fact as well. And that really doesn't create a good business relationship. So either the Canadian government, they want to either work with Saudi Arabia and try and reduce these human rights record abuses, or we have to stand on our own and, you know, create our own oil reserves, live off our own oil reserves, and still trade with the world market as well. So it seems like there's two very clear options for what the government should be doing here, and they're not really doing either one of them.
Yeah, and you know, anytime, as I said, you can shine the lights on the human rights issue in Saudi Arabia, that's a good thing. Anytime you can talk about lowering oil prices and fuel prices at home, that's a good thing as well. Anytime you can talk about developing the economy, that's a good thing as well. So this story really should be a blessing in disguise for all parties involved who are Canadian. But if you look at what's in the media, you'd think it's a major travesty and it's a major diplomatic blunder. But this is a point for growth and a huge opportunity for everyone involved. All right, so we're going to move on to our firing line segment now. That's the story that is, you know, taken out of context in the media very grossly. And, you know, it ultimately does come down to the headline for this. And the headline this week is Maxime Bernier criticizes liberals for extreme multiculturalism. So Quebec Conservative MP Maxime Bernier criticized the government this week for extreme multiculturalism, as he put it, or as the CTV story on the subject matter put it. Tory MP Bernier criticized for saying more diversity will destroy what makes Canada great. So recall Maxime Bernier, who was recently removed from the Conservative shadow cabinet just a little more than a year ago, lost the federal Conservative leadership race by less than 2% to current Conservative leader Andrew Scheer. Bernier has also been known for taking shots at Canada's supply management system, which is, of course, the system that enforces dairy quotas and dairy prices in Canada, which is seen by many as a stumbling block to getting a NAFTA negotiation happening and completed with the United States. So this past weekend, Bernier tweeted, and I'm going to read this entire tweet thread here because it's long, but, you know, context is needed for this story just because we need to get the full picture here. So it reads as follows. Trudeau keeps pushing his diversity is our strength slogan. Yes, Canada is huge and diverse country. This diversity is part of us and should be celebrated, but where do we draw the line? Ethnic, religious, linguistic, sexual, and other minorities were unjustly repressed in the past. We've done a lot to redress those injustices and give everyone equal rights. Canada is today one of the countries where people have the most freedom to express their identity, but why should we promote ever more diversity? If anything and everything is Canadian, does being Canadian mean something? Shouldn't we emphasize our cultural traditions that we have built and have in common, what makes us different from other cultures and societies? Having people live among us who reject basic Western values, such as freedom, equality, tolerance, and openness, doesn't make us strong. People who refuse to integrate into our society and want to live apart in their ghetto don't make our society strong. Trudeau's extreme multiculturalism and cult of diversity will divide us into little tribes that have less and less in common, apart from their dependence on government in Ottawa. These tribes become political clientels to be bought with taxpayers' money and special privileges. Cultural balkanization brings distrust, social conflict, and potentially violence, as we are seeing everywhere. It's time we reverse this trend before the situation gets worse. More diversity will not be our strength. It will destroy what has made us such a great country. And you see, he did say there that it will destroy what has made us such a great country. But the context involved with this effectively says something else, that if you add more diversity to the point where Canada no longer ceases to be a country as it is, that we know of Canada, you're not going to have a country left. And you can find the entire Twitter thread that Maxime Bernier wrote in our show notes at westerncontext.ca. Many other politicians, including former Ontario NDP Premier and interim Liberal leader Bob Rae, condemned the tweets as racist. And Andrew Scheer's spokesperson said that Canada has been built by people from all over the world coming here to enjoy the freedom, prosperity, and equality that our country offers. Conservatives will continue to recognize and celebrate the contributions made to Canada from people from diverse backgrounds that have enriched our history and society. So this was, you know, by all attempts, a mean to distance the party from Bernier's stance. Other MPs, including former leadership contender Aaron O'Toole and Tony Clement, also joined the chorus condemning Bernier on this. Politics has ultimately here entered a world where messages and metaphor are more important than the actual words that a politician speaks or the policy that accompany the words. And what this effectively means is that the politician's words are lost to the wind, to the point where, at this point in 2018, only directionality matters. So some politicians get this. Bernier probably does. Donald Trump gets this in the United States. And this is what Maxime Bernier was saying here, is that, yes, diversity is good for Canada, but at the same time, we need to be watching our country and ensuring that we still have a central Canadian identity left. And, you know, with this, Bernier was ultimately going to later clarify this. And he said he was not criticizing the current diversity in Canada, but rather more diversity. And I think that if you read the entire tweet feed, you can see that it's more diversity. And that's why I provided the full context for the tweet, is because later this clarification did ultimately come. And in his clarification, he said that Canada has always been a diverse country, and this is part of who we are. I love this Canada, but there is a difference between recognizing diversity and pushing for ever more of it. Something infinitely diverse has no core identity and ceases to exist. Now, this is an interesting time to be talking about this, because recently we've been talking a lot about the southern border, our southern border, and if you follow us on social media, you'll note that we shared a story with some data that says a strong majority of Canadians now view the issue of illegal border crossers into Canada to be at a crisis point. And this is playing exactly to a current affairs event that's happening. If there is indeed a crisis point on our southern border, we should be talking about that. And that's the tone that Bernier sets. He's talking about the issue, but he's talking about it from a different angle. And the people who are calling Maxime Bernier a racist were never going to vote for the Conservative Party or vote for him to begin with. If Canadians do indeed view the border issue as a crisis, this is indeed a valid discussion to be having. And I think everyone who lives on the border or who is at least concerned with the people coming into Canada should take an interest in this story. But if you read the CTV headline on this and you don't do your own due diligence on the matter, you'll have the feeling that perhaps Maxime Bernier is a racist, and anyone who shares his view of more people coming into Canada, increasing diversity, is ultimately a bad thing. And we have to also remember that Maxime Bernier is from Quebec. And identity, national identity, and nationalism on the whole may be a taboo subject in the rest of Canada to talk about and run an election campaign on, but in Quebec, it's part of the job description. And that's what gets the job done in Quebec if you're speaking to Quebecers. Quebec identity and Quebec nationalism. And that's exactly what Maxime Bernier is doing in what he said here. And we know Justin Trudeau is the polar opposite on this, because when he speaks, when talking in 2015 to the New York Times, he said that he considers Canada the first post-national state, meaning that there would be no core identity for Canadians and no mainstream as to what's normal in Canada. And that's what Justin Trudeau sees Canada as, and perhaps that's why we've seen this government be a little bit slow on addressing the border issue, except only addressing it once the polls say that, yes, this is indeed an issue for the majority of Canadians out there. And in the CTV article on the matter, if you're reading this, it's not until the ninth paragraph that Bernier's clarification actually comes in, and CTV doesn't even include the links to any of the tweet threads on this matter. So if you were reading purely from CTV, you'd be forced to do your own due diligence, and you might be left to some conclusions that are not necessarily true. And I think we need to take this debate up a level to the point that if we can't discuss a policy that was initially suggested by Pierre Trudeau, multiculturalism, and later enacted by progressive conservative Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, what does that have to say about the level of discourse in Canada today? And what is the media actually eager to talk about if you can't have a talk about multiculturalism without being called a racist? And a question that everyone should be asking for this, that the media didn't ask, and they should have been jumping at the bit to ask, was what does it mean to be Canadian in 2019, or 2018, if they're asking it today? And, you know, we've mentioned this previously, that the 2019 race will be one where people are called racists. And it's already begun for something that was a tweet that is talking about a core issue that exists on the southern border, and an issue that has been, you know, par for the course to talk about in Quebec politics for a generation or two.
Yeah, I think that's something that was completely missed here, is that there is a topic of multiculturalism going on in the discourse in the media lately, and a lot of it has to do with the with what people say on either side, and they're trying to divide people into different categories, those who believe in more multiculturalism, those who don't. It's almost like the statue issue all over again, when they're trying to divide people into different compartments so that they can reject those that they don't believe in and then cozy up to those that they do. But they're forgetting to make the connection in a lot of these articles that are talking about Bernier. They're forgetting to make the connection about the southern border issue that's been going on for the better part of a year and a half, almost as long, if not longer, than we have been doing this show for. And we're now on episode 80, so this is 80 different times this week, or this throughout, that we have been talking about. 81, I am hearing. 81, so that's even just more so the fact that this is 81 different weeks that we have been talking about this issue, and that the government still hasn't addressed it for. Now, this is something that hasn't really been talked about very much, because when it comes to the border, there are a lot of different people coming over the border, and they're just walking over, and there's been a lot of discourse about whether the word should be illegal or whether it should be irregular. I think anything that is illegal is irregular, but not everything that is irregular is illegal. I think that's pretty clear in this case. And something that hasn't been talked about very much is what is going to happen to these people that come over after they come in. Now, when Trudeau first brought in all of the Syrian refugees, the many thousands that he promised to bring in, there hasn't really been much follow-up with all of them and how they're integrating into Canadian life, how they're coping, how are they getting jobs and making money, how are they dealing with their housing. And there hasn't really been much governmental oversight on all of that as well. And considering that they brought them in for that reason, it's almost thinking that they brought them in just for almost a publicity stunt. And they seem to be doing the same sort of thing with the southern border, illegal border crossers that are coming over as well. And this is something that Bernier, I believe, is talking about. Even though he doesn't mention it, this is what he's talking about in general broad terms. And people are going after him because of this, but I think this is basically what it comes down to. And it's not really something that the media has been talking about very much.
Yeah, and like I said, it's all the directionality that matters on this. And, you know, if this is indeed shaping up to be what the 2019 campaign is going to be about, and the Conservatives are distancing themselves from one of their members who is having a legitimate discussion on that, that's something that they should also be wary of as well, is that in order to change minds, in order to win votes, in order to win an election, you need to have a conversation with people. Sometimes you need to discuss things that are uncomfortable. I think everyone agrees that there is a core Canadian identity. What that is might be up for debate. But at the end of the day, there is a Canadian identity that needs to be upheld. Every federal party, I believe, has the Canadian flag in their party logo. And that should say something about that as well, is that these political parties are indeed Canadian, and they should at least be able to talk about what Canadian identity is in the 21st century. And if you're called racist for doing that, then that's a problem.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think that's something that the media has to talk about, is that everyone wants to be Canadian when it's convenient to them. When you go down the street and you pass all the buildings and all the businesses that all have Canadian flags in their name, and they say they're 100% Canadian, and they go up with it, they also want to say that they're Canadian to drive more business. But then when it comes down to it, we're not really sure what Canadian is anymore, because of all these all of the different governments of the day that are trying to promote all these different policies. So it's kind of hard to keep track as to what a Canadian actually is anymore, and that's something that should be discussed about, and it's very hard to do that without either being shot down completely or being grouped in with a bunch of radical right-wing groups as well. And that's something that really shouldn't be happening in a country, of course, that espouses free speech, that we should be able to at least talk about in a civil discourse without resorting to name-calling as well.
And I think that leads us nicely into our word of the week. So what do we got for that this week?
So the word of the week this week is multiculturalism, which ties in very nicely to our firing line story. And that is defined as the presence of or support for the presence of several distinct cultural or ethnic groups within a society. And for example, this can be explained by Trudeau's the Trudeau government's commitment to the values of multiculturalism. And I think beyond that, multiculturalism is not just what it's defined as. It's kind of brought a bigger connotation, as it's almost evolved into its own language as a word being used to, by a lot of groups to say that they are multicultural, in the sense that they're open and they're welcoming to a lot of different people. And to believe in multiculturalism is to be nice to people that aren't the same as you. And I think that's something that language has kind of evolved into, in that if you aren't a belief in multiculturalism, well, that just means that you hate people and that you don't want anyone else to talk to you. And that's something that you see a lot of online, and people forget the actual definition of the word is meaning that it's basically a society that has two distinct different groups in it. And a lot of people, when they're talking about Canada, they're not really talking about Canada in the sense of those few distinct ethnic or religious or cultural groups. They're talking about Canada as everyone joining this same thing as what makes us all Canadian, you know, whether we're all hockey fans or whether we're all going with our maple syrup, as we talked about earlier, that all makes us Canadian. But it's very clear that there's not that level in Canada today, as we see with our firing line, as we see with our statue story, and even as we see with a lot of other things going on these days as well, when it comes down to the stance against Saudi Arabia as well.
Yeah, and you know, you look at the exact words of multiculturalism and, you know, several distinct cultural or ethnic groups, and you know, that's fine. And that's what was initially suggested by Pierre Trudeau and put into place by Brian Mulroney, multiple distinct cultures within Canada. Whereas if you compare that to the United States, for example, everyone is supposed to all melt in and mix in and assimilate and become American and adopt the American culture and the American way of life. So that's a difference between Canada and the United States. And on its own, multiculturalism is a piece of Canadian identity. It's just a question of, if you go too far, you're diluting multiculturalism so that it doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, with the Bernier story, you could even say to a point that Maxime Bernier is totally promoting multiculturalism with this, because he wants the distinct cultures within Canada to maintain their identity. Whereas if you just bring everyone in and you basically distill everything down, you're going to lose that multiculturalism. So you could look at that story that way as well.
Yeah, so I think that's a good example of why multiculturalism is our word of the week this week.
Alrighty then. Well, that wraps up this episode of Western Context. Thank you for everyone listening. If you guys want full show notes, you can find that at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to us on any number of podcast listeners, iTunes, Pocket Casts, Stitcher, Google Play, you name it. All of that and how to do that can be found at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we post all the stories that we look at throughout the week, including the one that said that our immigration issue on the southern border was reaching a crisis point. That didn't make it into the show, but it was indeed there at Western Context on Facebook and Twitter, and also on our website, westerncontext.ca. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure that we look through all of the news stories of the week, talk about what the media is talking about, what they're not talking about, and make sure to delve through to the true side of the story so that you can get the information and context that you need to put you on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week.